Hello and welcome to the IEA podcast with me, Emma Revel. After today's episode, don't forget you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify and Podbean, and you can also check out the numerous episodes in our back catalogue. Lots of critics of globalisation, especially on the right, economic nationalists and communitarians, are feeling vindicated by the corona crisis. They see it as a crisis of globalism, arguing that open borders, easy travel and globe-spanning supply chains have left us vulnerable and exposed. Do they have a point? Could greater emphasis on national self-reliance and a more sceptical approach to trade, mobility and migration have kept us out of this mess? Once this is all over, should we simply return to business as usual, or should we see this crisis as an occasion for a fundamental rethink of our economic model? Air travel and mass tourism in particular have already come under fire long before the coronavirus pandemic for their impact on climate change. Does the pandemic lend additional weight to the environmentalist arguments advanced by Extinction Rebellion and the mass movement built around Greta Thunberg? Would it be irresponsible to press ahead, for example, building new additional runways at Heathrow and Gatwick once this is over? Economic liberals would argue that at the same time, information and communication technologies that have fueled globalisation and mobility have also made us more resilient to this crisis. Is this true? What would a similar crisis have looked like, say, 20, 25 or 30 years ago? Would it have been less bad, worse or about the same? I'm Emma Revel, Head of Communications at the Institute of Economic Affairs, and I'm joined, remotely of course, by our Head of Political Economy, Dr. Christian Niemitz, to discuss this further. Good morning, Christian.
Good morning.
So, Christian, is coronavirus an inevitable consequence of globalisation? I mean, it's easy to see how mass movement of people and products across the globe have spread this disease rapidly. After all, we've had professionals and tourists travelling from country to country. Surely that means the virus didn't have to work very hard to get halfway around the world.
Yes, there is some truth in that, in the sense that 50 years ago, if the virus had developed half a century earlier, this would not have happened because the Western world had almost no contact with China. China was in economic terms, a non-entity. It wasn't happening, economically speaking. The only contact with the West would have been some political tourism, because there were a lot of Maoists at the time. It was quite fashionable to travel to China and to praise Chairman Mao. So there was that. But otherwise, yeah, the virus would probably have stayed there. And it's also true today that if we were an isolated economy, then we probably wouldn't notice much of that. North Korea has no registered, no confirmed cases so far. However, the communitarians and the economic nationalists that we're talking about are not arguing for total isolation or for trying to turn the clock back to the way things were 50 years ago. They're saying, well, We should have some trade, some openness, but just not too much. It's about moderation. Let's meet somewhere in the middle. The trouble with that is that there is no obvious correlation between how open an economy is and how badly the country is affected by coronavirus. There is no visible correlation between the openness of the economy and the number of corona cases. It doesn't spread as in such predictable and systematic ways. It spreads in much more random ways. All it takes is one person who is infected, the super spreader, and then a couple of days later you can have hundreds of cases. So it isn't as easily predictable as that. You couldn't say that if we were in some way less open, if we had whatever higher tariffs on Chinese products, then it would be less bad. That is not how this works. And that is why I don't accept the idea that that critics of globalization have been vindicated by this. Because yes, it's true, lots of people have been uneasy with globalization for a long time, but none of them predicted problems of the kind that we are experiencing today. As far as I'm aware, none of them ever talked about pandemics or viruses. Yes, they were opposed to globalization, but not for that reason. And that's why I don't accept that those people, the argument that those people have been vindicated, because that would be like saying my horoscope has been vindicated, because the horoscope says, I don't know, some financial problem would sort itself out. Yes, of course, if you keep your predictions vague and general enough, then they will sometimes come true. But unless you were right for the right reason, unless something specific that you predicted came true, you can't claim that you can't claim vindication. And as I said, if it were the case that you can systematically say more open economies are worse affected, economies with more exposure to China are worse affected, then they would have a bit of a point. But that is that is clearly not the way it works. Because ironically, if there is a success story in all this, it's Taiwan. And because they are the of all developed economies, they have perhaps best cope with the crisis. They had to have a very low infection rate and very few deaths. And they are far more exposed economically to China than we ever were, for geographic reasons alone. I think what they've done right, and I can't talk about in their public health strategy in detail. That's not something I know a great deal about. But their overall approach seems to be that they're quite happy to trade with China quite extensively. It's their most important trading partner. They're happy with cross-border movement, investment and all that. But they don't trust the word that the Chinese government says. So their attitude seems to be economic cooperation, yes, but combined with political skepticism, even political hostility towards the Chinese government, and that seems to have worked. That strikes me as exactly the right approach.
Interesting balance. I mean, you're saying that globalization isn't responsible for this, and the people saying it is are just sort of, they've been making vague anti-capitalist pronouncements for their entire careers, basically. Yeah. But there is a growing movement that claims that globalization is the issue. Do you think that globalization and free markets and free trade can survive this pandemic? Or will people's instincts be a bit more protectionist? Are we going to clamp down on travel and stop relying on imports, for example?
That could be, because what happens during crises is that often people double down on their pre-existing beliefs. This is what happens now, that the people who say we should now limit globalization, so for example, Nick Timothy, the communitarian conservative guru, he's saying this because he's been saying this for years, feeling vindicated. But it's always people who have always made that case are now using the corona crisis to make it. And you can see this in lots of areas, that lots of commentators, whatever their pre-existing worldview was, are now claiming, now even more. This shows that I'm right. Paul Mason, the socialist Trotskyite commentator, says, oh, this is clearly a crisis of capitalism. What we need is a fundamentally different economic system. What we need is socialism. Brendan O'Neill, of course, is saying this is about elites sneering at ordinary people, which is, of course, what he says about everything. Everyone doubles down on their pre-existing convictions, that there's a lot of confirmation bias and hindsight bias going on. And that's where I see the danger, that if these narratives become conventional wisdom, then yes, it could lead to a backlash in that sense. But mostly in the way that, I mean, we can't predict what exact policy measures that will lead to. But it could be that if there is a general climate that somehow globalization has failed, somehow open borders have failed, that people will come up with all sorts of trade restrictions, travel restrictions that are totally unrelated and wouldn't have stopped this particular crisis, but that nonetheless get some traction because they fit into that overall mood, into that overall narrative. That's where I see the danger.
Yeah, so we end up taking measures, or other countries take measures that affect us that actually have nothing to do with coronavirus. They wouldn't have stopped it in any way. They didn't contribute to it spreading. But people are just feeding into that narrative that says, actually, this came from elsewhere and it came because we're so connected. So naturally, we should take a step back. I mean, this is something I'm seeing in people's, you know, friends and family social media posts. I think the way that Britain has handled this in a kind of, we're in a warlike setting, naturally, British people seem to default to the Second World War, and we must buy British and we must grow our own food and that kind of thing. And people seem to think that sounds like the right response to them, even though if you look at it in a in a scientific way or in an economic way, that's not the right way to deal with it.
Yeah, of course, the way you make yourself resilient, generally speaking, being resilient in economic terms means not putting all your eggs in one basket. Mm. If we cut all international supply chains, then try to become self-sufficient, what would happen if the next crisis originates here? Yeah. You could say it's of course less likely that we will get a virus of that sort, because that emanated because of specific conditions. But the next crisis will not be a pandemic. It will be something completely different. It could be something where interconnectedness helps. But generally speaking, spreading your risks, hedging your bets, that is the way to go. And that is the reason why the only places that still have famines or massive food shortages today are places like North Korea, which are isolated, because if they have a bad harvest, they have nothing else to draw on.
Whereas if
we had a bad harvest domestically, we wouldn't even notice, because such a small proportion of the food that we consume is produced domestically.
Very interesting. I mean, mass tourism and aviation, so people and products moving across the world, have contributed slightly to how this disease has spread. It has meant it's moved a little bit faster. But these are two things that were coming under fire way before coronavirus for their impact on the planet generally. Does this pandemic prove people like Greta Thunberg right? Were Extinction Rebellion protesters, did they have a point saying we should all stop going on holidays and stay at home a little bit more? I mean, we've all seen the great, you know, really interesting looking graphs that show pollution levels in the world's major economies have plummeted now that we're all staying at home and no one's working in polluting industries. So, you know, are they right? Did they have a point?
In the sense that CO2 emissions are closely related to economic activity, yes. We saw this also during the financial crash and the subsequent recession and downturn, that CO2 emissions were going down everywhere. It is, at least in a short, medium term, very closely related to economic activity. And if people stay at home and do nothing, then yes, then CO2 emissions go down. The question is, do we want to live in a world like this? Do we want the current situation to go on indefinitely? I think in most cases the answer is no.
Many people have argued that actually what this pandemic does show us is what is necessary to achieve the drastic reduction in carbon emissions that people like Greta and Extinction Rebellion are talking about. So actually, in the end, this might undermine Extinction Rebellion's aims, because people will look and go, oh, okay, that did achieve a massive reduction in carbon emissions, but actually my quality of life was horrible and I didn't leave the house and I couldn't do anything fun or go to work.
Yeah, I hope that's the way it's going to turn out. I hope that is going to turn public opinion against this version of environmental hysteria. Because the thing is, you can make a good economic case for a modest carbon tax. There are all sorts of estimates of the social cost of carbon, but they all show that climate change is not the end of the world. You can justify some level of carbon taxation, but not the sort of prohibitive level that you would need to get us to a net zero economy in a matter of years. And this has always been a hysteria, and it's simply because people join this movement because everyone else seems to join it, and it seems to be the fashionable thing to do. And that's easy as long as you're talking about it in abstract terms. Net zero, okay, doesn't mean much to the average person, I guess, but if once you make it clear what that entails, and that it would entail very drastic reductions in living standards, hopefully that should reduce the enthusiasm about this a bit. But I'm not convinced that people will make that connection. I do remember at the onset of the financial crisis 12 years ago, there was also just before that, there were people saying actually a crisis would be good. because we are too consumerist, we're too materialistic, and this would be a purifying experience. A reduction in living standards is good. George Monbiot wrote this article in, I think, the early stages of the recession, where it wasn't yet clear how bad it was going to be. An article entitled Bring on the Recession, where he did say a reduction in living standards would be good. And then during the crisis, those people went silent. In fact, the same people who had been arguing for stopping or reversing economic growth were suddenly criticizing austerity, when the truth is, of course, that a shrinking economy, if you want to stop economic growth forcibly, then that would mean permanent austerity. That would mean specifically engineered austerity. Austerity would be the point rather than a reaction to an adverse event. There was the New Economics Foundation and the whole degrowth movement, as they called it, the anti-growth movement, really. They then went silent because it suddenly didn't seem like such an attractive idea anymore. Suddenly we had a shrinking economy. And it turned out, surprise, surprise, the shrinking economy is terrible. Surprise, surprise, yes, of course, GDP isn't everything, but it helps with a lot of things. A lot of the other things that we value are easier to achieve when GDP is growing than when it is shrinking. However, as soon as the economy was more or less back to normal, those same voices were back in fashion and continued as if nothing had happened. And the same could happen now. It could be that in the short term, yes, I guess Extinction Rebellion is not going to celebrate the corona crisis now. They're not going to say, oh, look, finally we're achieving a reduction in CO2 emissions. Isn't it great? They're now going to go silent on that. But let's say half a year later, the whole thing is more or less forgotten. We just remember the funny memes. And then this will suddenly come back into fashion. And I guess they will just downplay the connection with the last time CO2 emissions fell, which is now. They will say, oh, no, we'll do it differently. It will be nothing like that.
We will cut CO2 emissions, but we will do it in emissions.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah. Real net zero has never been tried.
Exactly. I mean, there's no good time for a pandemic, of course, naturally. But you've actually argued that globalization means we're better prepared to cope with coronavirus and the associated restrictions that we're all living under than we would have been in previous generations. I mean, you don't mean the Victorian era. Obviously, we're better prepared than our ancestors would have been. But you mean even in the very, very near past, sort of 20, 30 years ago, this would have been much harder to live through than it is now?
Yes, absolutely. It would have been a total nightmare if this had happened 25 years ago. Firstly, the economic impact would have been vastly greater, because with the technology that we had then, most people couldn't have worked from home. It would just not have been a realistic option. And the psychological impact would have been vastly greater as well, because it would have been a much more isolating experience. Keeping in contact with the rest of the world is just far easier when you have social media broadly defined, and it's also much easier to distract yourself and to stay sane.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much that I've done today that we wouldn't have been able to. I mean, we wouldn't have been able to do this podcast for a start. We wouldn't have been able to, you know, when we finish work at the end of the day, we wouldn't have been able to put Netflix on. I wouldn't have been able to Skype my parents. This would have been it would have been a lot lonelier 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, and these technologies that we're using, they have entered everyday life very quickly, and we quickly became used to them. And therefore, it's easy to assume that it feels as if they had always been around. It's easy to forget that these are very recent developments, really. It's if you watch a movie from 30 years ago, it doesn't feel particularly old. It doesn't feel like this is something from a different era. It's all pretty much... It doesn't seem as if the world had changed massively since then. But in terms of communication and information technology, in terms of the way we access information, communicate with other people, yes, it has changed massively. In the late 90s, most people didn't even have computers. In I think it was something like 1 in 4 households who had a computer at home. And then most of those didn't have internet access. It was something like 1 in 10 households in the late 90s having internet access. Now, good luck trying to work from home. If you have a computer at home, you're using that in an office environment. If you have a computer at work, but none at home, then what do you transfer your data to? And even if you had been one of those early adopters of home computers and internet access, it wouldn't have helped you a lot, because the internet, of course, is a network good. If you're the only one at your workplace who has internet connection, then who do you connect to? Then it's not particularly useful. It would be like being the only one who has a telephone in a society where that's very rare. Then, well, there's no one to call, and then it's not a particularly useful good. And it would have been like that. And therefore, the number of people being able to work in a productive way from home would have been minuscule compared to today. And that means the economic drop would have been severe. And then the all the measures that we can afford now to cope with the crisis are related to the fact that the downturn isn't that severe. A lot of the economy can go on, even if it is in this not particularly pleasant and slightly awkward way, but we can carry on. A lot of economic activity nowadays doesn't have to involve going to an office, being present physically. It can be replaced. It's just that it feels like a drastic change now because social norms haven't caught up with it yet. We most people still go to an office, but that's because of a lag effect. It's our social norms, and so far as they're work-related, still reflect the technology from 30 years ago. They haven't caught up yet. It's just out of habit. It's just what you do in the morning. You get up and you go to an office because that's the way it's always been. And we haven't really thought about the implications of new technologies, whether we can do it differently. There are even people saying that this will lead to a permanent shift towards home working. I'm not convinced by that. But the fact that people are talking about it is in itself telling. This isn't something that anyone would have said if the same crisis had happened 25, 30 years ago. There it would have been clear, to the extent that it's possible at all, it is a very inconvenient and roundabout way to substitute for office work, and it would have been clear that it's not going to catch on.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. Right. Thank you, Christian, for joining me today. If any of our listeners are interested in the IEA's thoughts on the future of home working, we have a briefing by Professor Len Shackleton called Pass the Remote. It's available on the IEA website if you would like to check it out. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the IEA podcast on whatever medium you use to get your podcasts. Thank you very much.